So let's get started. Our host for tonight's event, you know very well, as Michigan Radio's program director and also the host of It's Just Politics, and also quite well known as Michigan Radio's resident political junkie, it's Zoe Clark.
Hi. Hello. Hello. Thank you. Well, now you have your social calendars scheduled through spring, thanks to Steve. So I want to introduce the folks to my left, physically, not politically speaking necessarily. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News. You probably see his byline all over the place. He's also a frequent guest on Stateside, so welcome to J.O. Chad Livengood, who really like to introduce more as Maddie's father, later asked Chad to see a photo of his cutest daughter, who I'm obsessed with. So, you know, just so you know. Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business. These two dudes together have basically broken every big story in Michigan. So someone, once we open questions, ask them what they're working on and we'll know what we're reading about next week. And then Robert Yoon, a first-time panelist on Issues and AL, we are thrilled to have you here. A visiting professor right now at the University of Michigan, teaching basically every class in poli-sci and comm that I ever want to audit. Plus, basically the coolest job, I think at least, that you had for, what, 16 years before that, produced every single CNN presidential debate. So basically, after this is done, take him to the bar, buy him a few drinks, and I'm sure we'll hear some really good stories about what that was like. I want to thank everyone out tonight. I no longer believe, as one guest who was sitting here earlier said, that there are only Republicans in Livingston County. I don't actually believe that there are Republicans or Democrats anymore in this country, or at least in Michigan. I think it's whether or not the big divide now is you turned down your thermostat last week to 65 degrees or not. Still trying to understand how that became such a political issue there. But first, Jonathan Osting, we have had a Democratic governor now for five, going on 6 weeks. What's changed? Does Michigan look different?
So some of Governor Whitmer's biggest priorities are gonna take some time working with the legislature, but what she has the power to do, she has moved pretty quickly to do. In concert, I'm sure we'll talk more about the Attorney General and the Secretary of State, also Democrats, now helping run state government, and they've made some fairly aggressive changes fairly quickly. Governor Whitmer primarily has used her power of executive directives first, and now today executive orders to create some new rules for state government and also reorganize state government. Just today, she signed two executive orders basically revamping and reconfiguring the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, folding in not just environmental issues, but also energy initiatives, climate change work. She joined a new accord of different states around the country that are trying to adhere to the Paris Agreement, even though the federal government is no longer doing so, and also is making permanent and bolstering a PFAS action response team started by Governor Snyder. So that all happened today. She previously used a whole bunch of executive directives to tell state government how to treat employees, address some ethical concerns. Two of her big executive directives for state government dealt with LGBT discrimination and an attempt to change. To close any gender wage gap that might still exist in state government. So, none of it's surprising. I mean, these are all issues she talked about on the campaign trail. And until she, unveils her budget and starts working with the legislature on some bigger ticket items, these are things she's been able to do just with the power of the pen.
And Chad, let's pick up there, right, of course, because we have a Democratic governor the first time in 8 years, but what we don't have for the first time in 8 years is a Democratic legislature. You still have both the House and the State Senate under Republican control, albeit to a lesser degree. What has changed in Michigan over the past 5 weeks, other than what J.O. just listed? If there was
One thing Governor Whitmer hasn't done yet is fix one damn road. and she's, I mean, she intends to, but this is all going to come down to sort of a same old debate that Governor Snyder went through with the legislature. How do you raise more than $1 billion or maybe $2 billion more in revenue every year to put into roads infrastructure and underground infrastructure? I mean, during the campaign, right at the end, go out and talk to people, especially in the suburbs of Detroit, and they weren't all talking about roads. They were talking about water and being more concerned about it. And then you have lots of places outstate who have been affected by these PFAS and contamination or just have in the back of their mind the horror story of Line 5 blowing up and spilling oil into Lake Michigan. And they're really concentrated on that. So, I mean, that water issue is a pretty winning issue across the board. But the legislature, the Republican leadership is still very divided about what to do about roads. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, he thinks we should just kind of stick with the current plan, fully fund it, get to 2021, that this is the plan they passed in 2015, the $1.2 billion plan, and then reassess. The new House Speaker, Lee Chatfield, he wants to try to get the sales tax off of gasoline, that none of that money goes to your roads. And it's $900 million to $1 billion a year that goes to school aid fund, essentially, but none of it goes into the roads. And it's a real big rub. We tried back in 2016 with this, 2015, with this ballot initiative proposal one to raise the sales tax by 1 cent. And the voters voted it down 80% no to 20% yes. Who in here in this room actually voted for that? Yeah, that's about right. Yep, yep, yeah.
I saw three hands.
It was three out of 100. I mean, it was so badly defeated. And but that plan was all based on trying to get rid of the sales tax on gasoline so that all the taxes you pay at the pump go to the roads. And that thing went down in flames. The new House Speaker wants to try that again, basically. So they're already kind of at dividing lines here.
Robert, I'd love your view, being the newest to Michigan and looking at the political scene in Michigan. You and I talked about this the last time we were talking politics. Michigan went six cycles for a Democratic president, went for Trump in the latest, the first time in decades. Is Michigan a red state? Is it a blue state? Is it a purple state?
Yes. Next question.
You're good, Yoon. You're good.
Well, there's a lot of arguments you can make for all of those. When you look at just the pure closeness, if you think of red, the state of being red or blue as just how competitive the state is, then it's the purplest state in the country with the narrowest vote percentage. But you know, for years it has this history of voting voting Democrat in presidential elections, which the national media kind of defines as being the ultimate metric for being a blue state.
Right.
But also at the same time, throughout that same period, Michigan voters elect Republican governors and Democratic governors, and hasn't been a Republican senator in a while. But on the down ballot races, things tend to get mixed up pretty much. So in that respect, Michigan is one of the most down the road and contestable states in the country. And I like to watch the starts of administrations, like we're seeing now. And there are a lot of parallels with the start of a new presidential administration. Franklin Roosevelt kind of set the precedent for trying to get a lot of highly visible accomplishments done in the first
100 days.
I don't know if Gretchen Whitmer has actually set 100 days as a benchmark or anything, but clearly she's plucking the low-hanging fruit, things that she has the power to do unilaterally, and she's doing. I thought over the weekend it was interesting, at the Michigan Press Association, she unveiled her the transparency reforms and the FOIA reforms.
Well, and I want to dig in on that because as journalists at this table, Jonathan, you're smirking a little. Is it true FOIA reform? And first, maybe explain what that looks like and what maybe journalists would prefer to see from the administration when it comes to FOIA and what it was, the directive. And then I want to make sure, too, before you answer that, I love that I gave you a little like, hey, so by the way, but first, we want questions from you, or else, as you can tell, we will just continue to talk. So if you've got questions, throw your hands up, and we will get to you as soon as possible. So as you start throwing your hands up, FOIA, and what did Whitmer do on Friday, and what would we have maybe liked more as journalists?
Yeah, sure. So the governor signed an executive directive again, which basically what she said it closed loopholes in the state's Freedom of Information and Open Meetings Acts. She basically used her power to direct state governments to, if they can, speed up the process, create a new FOIA position separate from a FOIA administrator to sort of work with the public and figure out ways maybe to reduce the costs and expense and time it takes to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests. All good things. I'm fine with it. I hope that it's effective. Of course, the governor didn't address what is the largest, obvious, glaring loophole in Michigan's Freedom of Information Act, which is that it doesn't apply to her office and to the state legislature. All the gubernatorial candidates in the Republican and Democratic primaries last year all said they were on record supporting expanding FOIA to the governor's office and the state legislature. But doing so, of course, requires a change in the law. And Governor Whitmer, last week at least, decided not to voluntarily open her up, her office up to Freedom of Information Act requests, which she could have done. And in fact, she did say as a candidate that if the legislature doesn't act to change the law, she would do that. But basically, as of last week, she said, well, I don't want to play my cards just yet. I want to work with the legislature to try and change the law first. I think it would be better if that was the route we went and both the legislature and the governor's office were subjected to FOIA. That's fine if she, you know, 6 months or a year from now is still saying that and the legislature still isn't acting. I think it's time to hold their feet to the fire a little more and say, well, when are you going to live up to your campaign pledge? You're voluntarily doing that.
The reality is she doesn't want to do it now because then the legislature will have no motivation to do it themselves. I mean, this is one of the most glaring change differences that the legislature holds every level of government to this standard of law, makes everyone down to ambulance districts subjected to FOIA, but themselves in the governor's office. It's quite astonishing. Jonathan and I used to work at the Detroit News together, and we had sometimes displeasure of having to go through Rick Snyder's emails. And during the Flint water crisis, we went through hundreds of thousands of pages of emails that got disclosed. And that started with one of the advocacy groups in town got a hold of a trove of emails that a legislator, a Democratic legislator from Genesee County, requested out of the Department of Environmental Quality just before Flint really blew up big time the new year of 2016. And this legislator handed it off to Progress Michigan, the liberal advocacy group, which started like sending out like one or two copy emails a day, like greatest hits, like from these trove of emails, and they wouldn't say how they got them. And like we were kind of behind, and it was going to take forever to get a FOIA through. And I picked up the phone one day and called the governor's chief of staff, and I said, look, I'm getting tired of chasing these little emails every day. You're probably tired of them coming out. You probably got all these emails. Why don't you just give them to me? And he sort of contemplated this. This is Jared Agin now, communications director to the vice president. And like 10 minutes later, like another aide, Bill Nowling, a local guy here in Brighton area, Bill calls me up and says, we're going to give you 25,000 pages of emails tomorrow. And I said, what? And I'm like, why? He's like, we're the first one who asked. and said, holy shit. So I called Jonathan, you know, I was like, hey man, clear your schedule, we got it. And we ended up going to Detroit and working with our
They brought a pickup truck and they just threw 25,000.
Well, it was sort of like that. We went over and got a bunch of discs. And then we transferred the files, and then we drove to Detroit and camped out in the Detroit News for 3 days, reading these emails. But it was sort of moral of the story is, I'm a believer in FOIA, and if I have to use it, but I don't want to use it as a weapon. I don't want to have, if you, I just believe in government on demand, records on demand, that you should be able just to ask the government for, hey, give me a copy of the township budget. Aww, you shouldn't have to FOIA for it.
You're so cute.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know this experience at the governor's office doesn't happen very often, and we got like a special deal basically, but sometimes just asking, and then if they don't, then you prod them, and then you use all the pieces of the weaponry, so to speak. But that's kind of the process that we kind of work around some days, trying to sort of finagle this kind of stuff.
And just to be clear, that disclosure by the Snyder administration was very rare, to self-disclose.
One time.
Definitely the exception rather than the rule. Michigan is one of, I believe, two states in the country that exempts both the legislature and the governor's office. So we're an outlier here. It's not like we're just journalists complaining about this. Michigan is outside of the norm on
this. Did they redact the emails at all?
Some of them that were redactable. Jonathan actually made an amazing discovery. And so the governor ended up doing multiple. This was the first, the 25,000 was the first batch. Then there was like 10 more batches all the way to May. I mean, this went on from February until May, until spring.
Always very late at night. We'd get the FOIA back at like 9 p.m. after everyone was exhausted. One time in our newsroom, I think we got 6,000 pages at 9. And we were like, who's ordering the pizza? And who's calling? And then it was like, can you call the other one, significant other? Because I can't tell them again that I'm going to be late.
Well, one time we went over there and got some more from them. It was internal emails, but they were using... Well, guess what? They were using their private email addresses, and they decided that, well, you know what? This is going to come out through Congress or some investigation. We ought to just probably disclose this. So they disclosed it, and then tell them about the other part. There was pieces.
Yeah. So all of these emails were gone through by legal counsel Snyder for the Snyder administration, and they were sensitive material was redacted from them. But in this one batch we got, the redactions were. Not processed correctly. In other words, they were just black boxes basically flip-arted over top of the document, and I just clicked on one of the black boxes and I realized I could delete it. And it turned out I could do that on a lot of the emails.
And then we got to see what was behind it.
That's some Bernstein and Woodward stuff right there.
I think we found the governor's email address out of that, and maybe a couple of people's cell phone numbers.
Nerd1147@gmail.com.
We found Rich Baird's cell phone number out of that. Rich Baird, governor's right-hand man, and then I started to call him, and he didn't talk to me for several years. So there's a story.
Low-budget redacting.
So we went a little deeper into FOIA than I thought, but I'm glad you two had a little therapeutic session about what that was like. So I see some hands, so let's start the questions. And maybe just say your name and where you're from before you ask your question.
I'm John. I'm from Charlotte.
Hi, John.
And J.O., tell me about Wahlberg. All I saw was the tweet, and I had to get here because it's an hour away. Tell me about Wahlberg. He's my congressman.
Okay.
And so can you tell me about Wahlberg, gerrymandering, and where you think it's all going?
Yeah, sure. Just real quick, for context, there's a federal lawsuit that, in fact, is going to trial tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. because the Supreme Court today rejected a request by GOP lawmakers to delay that trial. This lawsuit alleges that in 2011, maps approved by the Republican-led legislature were intentionally drawn to dilute the vote of Democratic voters by packing or cracking them into certain districts. That's the allegation. Yes. Okay, I think you're being sarcastic. In any case, it's long been suspected that a key goal of the 2011 redistricting process was to protect Congressman Wahlberg. He was first elected to the U.S. House in 2008. Mark Schauer defeated him in 2006. Mark Schauer defeated him in 2008. Wahlberg repaid the favor in 2010. And then they redrew the districts in 2011 in a way that made the district more Republican. Emails released in this federal lawsuit over the weekend basically made clear that was a goal of the redistricting process. They actually used the language, the maps were intended to make the district more Republican for Tim Wahlberg. So that's just one of many emails that have come out in the lead up to this trial. Basically, Democratic attorneys, for the most part, are making the case of why it should go to trial. So trying to introduce as much evidence as possible. And I think it's going to be a fascinating trial because we're going to have not only experts on gerrymandering testifying, but also former Michigan Republican Party chairman Bobby Shostak.
You can tell this is an NPR crowd when you're talking about how excited you are about a court hearing and experts on redistricting. And we're like, tell me more.
Well, what it comes down to is that these emails and this trial are going to give us another look behind the veil of something that typically happens in private, that because Michigan is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act, we don't know all the details of what happened in 2011. But some of that is starting to trickle out, and I think more will over the next week or two in a public hearing. So, I'd be excited if it was Democratic emails being released too, but we're getting to see something we don't know that much about in greater detail, and that's why I'm fascinated.
And should say that the emails have come out kind of a trickle effect, and one of them too was, we're going to draw this map like it's giving the middle finger to one of the districts, so it's not just the Wahlberg congressional district.
Yeah, this email today was like, I think, more substantive, but not nearly as salacious as some of the emails that have come out describing drawing a district to give Sandy Levin the middle finger, describing efforts or suggestion anyways that we should pack all the Dem garbage into a specific district. So,
but Chad, all of this is happening in parallel with the fact that Michigan voters approved a ballot initiative in November that is going to change the redistricting process. Yeah. Talk a little bit about how these two, because I think for folks who are tangentially watching or hearing both newscasts and trying to figure out, like, how are these intersecting? Explain how these two are parallel with each other, that we are in 2020 still going to begin a new process.
Yeah, I mean, despite some conspiracy theories on the right, these two things started separate of each other. The League of Women Voters started this lawsuit, and the ballot committee, started by a 28-year-old named Katie Fahey, a recycling consultant, who just got upset about gerrymandering and started a little revolution on Facebook. They worked together. I mean, this all this information started coming out through the lawsuit and through news accounts about the process. And yeah, we got this look behind the scenes that typically, if there was legislators and legislative staff who were on some of these emails, and if we had access to FOIA, we might be able to find out about this. Maybe not necessarily. It's kind of hard to sort of know who's pulling the strings. And also, so a lot of this is done on private email too. But you have this parallel event now where we're going to have a process of redistricting after the 2021. So 2020 census in 2021, and it's possible that depending on the outcome of this case, if a judge rules in the favor of the League of Women Voters, they could then order a rewrite of the map for the 2020 election, just for the House representatives, which could then put it in play and make and also maybe even put some of the congressional seats in play.
And Robert, what I was just going to ask you is, speaking about whether it's a blue state or a red state, I mean, a lot of folks will say, no, Michigan is a blue state. It's specifically the fact about how these maps are drawn. And when you do the overall numbers, that more Democrats will vote for the candidates, but because how the maps are, that it's inherently unfair.
Yeah, if you look at election results and how Democratic voters or Democratic candidates fared, and then compare that to the state legislative boundaries, there's a very big disparity there. But one of the reasons I love redistricting as an issue is because you're able, it's something where you can really pinpoint when someone is making an argument based on principle versus whatever is expedient for their party. So my home state is Maryland, which is one of the states that's arguing this case before the Supreme Court.
Right.
And there the situation's pretty much the opposite, where the state legislature is controlled by Democrats. And back in 2000, the 2000 redistricting, they redrew the line specifically to get rid of a liberal Republican congresswoman. Anyway, so one of the districts now in Maryland, in the Baltimore area, looks like it's roughly the shape of when a bug hits your windshield. It's got all these tendrils.
Like a dandelion.
Right, and in Maryland, there was a ballot measure put before voters as well, but the Republicans were putting forth that measure, and it didn't pass because ultimately Democratic voters knew that this was going to benefit Republicans, and so it didn't go anywhere. But then the maps were still challenged in the courts. So I would love to see the issue of redistricting addressed by one body addressing all the issues throughout the country, and coming up with just a standard and having it applied uniformly.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I don't think I've ever seen an issue that the it was so complicated, really, that the electorate really just latched onto and understood, and that was sort of the ingeniousness of the Voters Not Politicians campaign. They didn't have any money. They went out, and I wrote about this in a profile about Katie Fahey. They went out and asked people on Facebook if anybody knew how to make clipboards, because they needed to pick extra large clipboards for the big legal paper so they could get the ballot proposals out and gather signatures. And to explain it, on one side they had the actual form that you fill out, and on the other side they had a copy of the local district that they were in to show them gerrymandering or show them strange boundaries and, you know, the 14th congressional district that somehow connects Pontiac with Del Rey. Which is a really quite an amazing accomplishment. You go like this and down to the east side and down to the southwest Detroit. And they just went around and they just presented it like that. And I remember last summer, in my hometown is Chelsea, I was at the Chelsea Parade in August, and there was a guy walking down the street, and he was dressed as the 7th Congressional District. And he had this cardboard cutout. And, up here is Eaton County, a strange little piece up here, and down here is Ann Arbor and down Branch and stuff. And I yelled at him, I said, "You look really gerrymandered." And he started laughing. He thought it was so funny, but no one else got it, you know, of course.
Michigan radio listeners.
But it was really just amazing how they ran this campaign and got people's attention and got people interested in a subject and didn't have to have a lot of money. They didn't have the UAW, the MEA, or Right to Life. Those are the three organizations before this that could actually pull off something like this.
And we should note, Right to Life had a paid lobbyist, basically, to be able to do this. And these were folks that did it without paid signatures. I think often there's this idea that when ballot initiatives happen, it's this sort of grassroots group of folks, and that's actually not how the majority of the time it works, right? Corporations, organizations sometimes pay $1 or $2 per signature. This organization, Katie Fahey, again, now 29 years old, managed to get this up and running. How many folks either signed a petition, you don't have to say that you did, or maybe saw one, right? And when you think something like 450,000 signatures on a grassroots effort, it's telling.
I'll just point out that while their signature gathering effort was grassroots and phenomenal, they did get a lot of money late from dark money Democratic groups. So if you're concerned about good government, there's another issue that came into play in that election as well.
That's a good segue, Jonathan.
You know, I spoke with one of the consultants who was involved with the TV campaign on behalf of the ballot measure, and she was saying that there was a huge, it's hard to get people riled up about redistricting if they don't know what redistricting is. Mm-hmm. And so there was their initial focus grouping or whatever, it was not a resonant, it was an issue that didn't really resonate with people. And so they tried different messaging, test messaging, and what really resonated with people in one of their ads was a the script in the ad was something about we want Michigan to be open and transparent, and so they had a neon sign of the word open, like at a diner, and then you pull the string, and then the light comes on, and you hear the buzz of the neon sign. Anyway, so she said that somehow that image of the idea of Michigan being open was really a breakthrough in terms of reaching or explaining the issue to a lot of voters, and something simple like that was helped explain the issue.
But as Jonathan notes, in order to pay for a big, you know, ad like that, money from out of state did come in, and there was a lot of talk about that it may be a very progressive issue, but again, kind of interesting bedfellows that a lot of progressives who want more open government or at least dark money to get out of the system really benefit from it in this initiative.
Yeah, that's right. There were two groups, and I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on their names. I don't know. Do you remember them, Chad? But two big out-of-state groups came in, and they're 501c nonprofits that don't disclose their own donors, and they pumped many millions of dollars into the campaign to help fund television ads. That's not to say there wasn't also an outpouring of small donors who contributed to the effort, but when you're talking about funding a huge television ad campaign and potentially outspending the opposition, you need money, and they took it where they could get it.
Yeah. Okay, more questions. I see, I'm getting pointed over. Oh yeah, in the way back.
Yes, I just have a question, but I have a comment. You're talking about gerrymandering, but in your whole discussion of your talking about it, you never said anything about how they, during the lame duck session, they made it worse. You know, and you can't talk about that and not tell people that it's worse now than it was before. I'll go back, and my original question was, when you're talking about her lame duck session, you're talking about what the governor can do now. How much money was taken out and spent during lame duck to screw this state and screw the governor so she can't do anything? And why don't you talk about that? Thank you.
So I think what you're talking about is the supplemental bill that happened later in lame duck. So should we start with that? And that is something that we've talked about, and actually was a bill that came very late in lame duck that a lot of legislators didn't even have time, if I remember correctly, to read the entire bill and to go through every single dollar that was spent. And that folks are still reading this legislation and still finding buckets of money going through certain things. You guys were both there covering lame duck. How shocked were you when you saw that supplemental and how much money was spent?
I mean, not really all that shocked. I mean, this is the last hurrah for the all-Republican legislature and governor. They know that they're not going to have the governor's office for 4 years, maybe eight, and they may not even have the legislature for the full 4 years. They could very well lose the House and maybe even lose the Senate in 2022. So they were doing what they could, and the spending was the last thing they decided to put off, and they spent about, it's a $1.3 billion bill. Now, about $500 million of it is actual, like, general fund money. A lot of it's pass-through or restricted funds. So $500 million is what they kind of had to play with, so to speak. Some of it's like what they refer to as one-time money. They don't think it's going to reoccur, or it's lapsed or whatnot. But it's a surplus funds. And actually, Governor Snyder wanted to put a bunch of money into the rainy day fund. And the legislature said, oh, no. No, this is our time. Now,
well, but to the point is that, you know, $500 million, half a billion, that could have gone to something that
they could have held on to it. They could have not spent it. I mean, they had some things they had to get done, or they thought they had to get done. But, you know, even that, they don't really have to do anything. But the biggest goodie basket, so to speak, was $113 million in grants, direct grants to all kinds of projects that paid for everything from mysterious sewer lines in Salem Township that the township didn't want to a playground in like Rochester Hills. I mean, there was literally a little bit of everything, but it wasn't for everyone though. I mean, it was only in certain districts. And I can get into that if you want.
So what you just yelled out was Shostak, and Shostak actually is a former GOP chair here in Michigan who that $20 million to the mysterious Salem Township. That $20 million went to building some infrastructure for some developments that the former chairman was building. And we had former majority leader of the Senate, Arlen Meekhoff, basically come and say, yeah, I did that for him.
Yeah, Bridge Magazine broke this story. Mike Wilkinson dug into this because they were looking at calling around and asking, and this was the big one. It was $10 million out of that $113 million. They got an initial $10 million in 2017 that no one even noticed as well. But when Mike called around and asked, everyone was like, I don't know how I got money got there. The appropriations chairs, Laura Cox and Dave Hildebrand, actually told him they don't know who wanted the money, and they don't know how it got requested. I mean, and I wrote a column about this whole sort of saga, and my thought about that was, well, that's horse pucky. I mean, if you're the CFO of the legislature and you lost $10 million, and basically is or you're lying. It's like one of the two, basically. But I got a hold of Arlen Meekhoff, and he because someone told me that he was the one who wanted it, and Meekhoff acknowledged, yeah, I sought this. It was not in his district. He lives in Ottawa County, and this is Salem Township in northeast Washtenaw County. But he said that it was presented as an economic development opportunity, and basically what it is that it's a rural area right off of Godfrenson Road on M14 where the Shostak Brothers real estate company bought a bunch of land in the late 90s, and they've been sitting on it trying to develop it, and the township told them they didn't want to pay for the sewer infrastructure. A lot of townships got in really bad trouble here in Livingston and Washtenaw County, got into trouble before the Great Recession in the 90s, buying and bonding on infrastructure and then getting stuck with the bill, and they're spreading the money out to all their taxpayers. So Salem Township said, you're going to have to come up with the money yourself. And as the township supervisor put it to me, I don't know anybody in Lansing, but Bobby Shostak does. He actually sort of built the legislature. He's one of the sort of 10 mega donors in the Republican Party, and he was the chairman who got Rick Snyder reelected, and the legislature.
And was also personally involved in redistricting meetings in 2011. Will probably be called to testify.
A lot of crossover here. Yeah.
So, Robert, from again that big perspective of covering politics nationally, you hear sort of an internal Michigan story like that, and do you sort of go, well, yeah, no wonder folks are angry at Lansing, and no wonder folks are angry at D.C.? I mean, it's not shocking.
Yeah, well, you see a lot of the same dynamics playing in Michigan that you'd see in other states also. With the issue,
I don't know if we should feel better or worse about that.
Well, yeah. You can feel that you're not alone, I guess. Right. But with the issue with the lame duck, obviously there were those huge protests also in Wisconsin when the Republican administration and was leaving office, and there are a lot of examples where the party leaving power in their final days in power will try to stick it to the incoming party. A few years ago, the same thing happened in North Carolina with the Republican governor and legislature curtailed the powers of the incoming Democratic governor. And I think that, for the most part, I think it kind of annoys voters. I think on some level, there is some bit of tribalism where whatever is good for your side, you're all for it. But there's also kind of a short-sightedness to that approach, because whatever it is that you're doing to stick it to the other guy, they're going to do to you when the situation's reversed. And in 2004, I think it was, when John Kerry was running for president, the Massachusetts legislature, they were worried that when Kerry became president, that that Mitt Romney was going to replace, be responsible for picking his replacement. So the Democratic state legislature in Massachusetts changed the law, taking away the power of the governor to appoint senators. But then what they ended up doing was there was a special election. Yep. because of this law. There was a special election when Ted Kennedy died, and they elected a Republican, and that Republican was the 60th vote for Obamacare.
Brown?
Scott Brown?
Yeah, Scott Brown. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He didn't last long, but when it mattered
he
for that
calendar,
Obamacare
yeah.
vote. And so that completely changed the National Democrats' approach to getting Obamacare through, all because of this, I guess, mean-spirited effort to stick it to Mitt Romney.
From 5 years earlier.
Yeah, yeah. So it always, I think, I mean, it doesn't always, but you have to be prepared that whatever it is you do can come back to haunt you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, question over here.
Mike, and I want to thank you for being here, one, and two, I worked the census at the turn of the last century, and for the last 18 years, I've been doing field research for the Department of Health and Human Services, and the threat, just the threat of having citizenship added to the census is making my work and that of my colleagues that much more difficult as people are getting more and more reticent to discuss things like health or anything else. And it's clear that the emphasis for this is coming from the administration and all those who want to restrict voting and participation in this country as citizens.
Well, thank you for that. And I assume that there's going to be a mad dash to find you and your contact information from Jonathan and Chad here to get the details on that.
This is already a concern in Southwest Detroit right now.
It's been a huge concern for folks, immigrants or not, or folks legally. Talk about what's happening in Southwest Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Duggan is living and dying by this campaign promise that he's going to grow the population of Detroit, and he needs to do it with everybody, not just these young millennials living downtown and midtown. And Detroit continues to be a popular place for Hispanic migrants to come to Southwest Detroit, and also Bangladeshi and other migrants who come into like Hamtramck and on that border, that Banglatown in Detroit. And there's a real concern is that they're just not going to fill out the census form, and we'll continue to see a technical decline of Detroit's population because there's thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who don't want to come out from behind the shadows.
There's a political subtext here, which is that census estimates are used to allocate how many congressional districts states get. So if undocumented immigrants aren't counted in the census, that doesn't count for state population counts, and states that have a lot of undocumented immigrants could lose some power in Congress as a result if the way those population estimates are divided are changed. So there is a possibility here that the argument is that the Trump administration is doing this in an attempt to punish states.
Former Governor Snyder talked a lot about wanting to get Michigan back to the 10 million mark, and for a large part actually of his administration talked about how he wanted folks coming to Michigan. In fact, at one point in his administration, he said he was the most pro immigrant governor, Republican or Democratic, in the entire country. So it'll be interesting to see what Governor Whitmer does to continue to try to keep borders open in Michigan, and maybe even something that she brings up in her State of the State address, which is happening not tomorrow night, but next week. Before we get to a question, quick 30-second scuttlebutt of why. Jonathan, you want to take that one?
Sure, yeah. So Governor Whitmer had announced her State of the State address would be tomorrow night. That was during the federal government shutdown. Of course, there was the whole hullabaloo over Speaker Pelosi not allowing Trump to deliver his State of the State, State of the Union as expected. Once the shutdown ended, she invited the president to deliver his speech tomorrow night, which is the same night as Governor Whitmer. Pretty clear she didn't want to be overshadowed or at least lose the attention of Michiganders she was trying to address, so she moved her speech back a week.
Okay, more questions.
Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Mom. I didn't pick the questioners, so I don't get, it wasn't nepotism on that one.
Actually, I want to just give a shout out that the co-host of It's Just Politics, is in the house with us tonight, Rick Pluta.
Rick Pluta.
And I
want to
give a big shout out. And with all due respect to your panel, I actually have a question I'd like to ask Rick. If you'd be, would you be on track?
Richard.
So for many of us, especially women, having Gretchen Whitmer be elected governor recently was a huge and wonderful, hopeful event. And I'm curious, Rick, do you feel like that this will help give Michigan a boost for the next election as far as being a player in national politics? And if you could answer briefly, that'd probably be great, but you know.
The last
I
part
guess
might
we're
be
done a here, you guys. We can. We got a new moderator, we got a new panelist, we're good.
We're in the period where, you know, we're in the setups, because every election is the setup for the following one, and I suspect it's just a matter of time. We don't know how long, and I'd love to hear your guys' take on this before Gretchen Whitmer is at least mentioned as a potential presidential candidate. We'll see how long or how seriously that is taken. Thanks, well, Mom.
She's already shot this down now.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, she got asked about it by Susan Demas from Michigan Vance, and she said she wasn't interested. And
well, neither was Barack Obama, though, in 2006.
Made all the normal comments that you make that you're not, it's not on your agenda, you know, except she didn't use that word. But yeah, I mean, there's inevitably you're going to hear some chatter about this because she's got upper Midwest, purple state creds, a dynamic female speaker, and one who's been underestimated a few times. I mean, just a year ago, there were still people trying to figure out how to get Gary Peters into the race.
Still people, Democratic Mayor Mike Duggan.
Yes, and the UAW president, Dennis Williams, at the time, were basically conspiring to try to get a primary challenger for Gretchen Whitmer. They doubted that she could win the primary, much less they doubted that she could go up against the Bill Schuette machine, since Schuette had been running for governor since sometime in the late 90s. And so... you know,
Schuette's been running since he was in third grade.
I thought I'd modify the joke, but yeah. But yeah, no, they just really didn't think that she had the chops, and she overcame. You know, there was a point this summer that people were like, "Oh, Abdul Al-Sayed's going to knock her off. You know, it's going to be crazy, and you know, and she's going to be a total flame out." And then she beat him by 12 points or
more than that.
More than that, yeah. It was huge, and so. I mean, she just kept defying the punditry expectations, and that's why, that's one of the reasons why she gets mentioned nationally.
Well, Robert, let's talk a little bit about sort of what was the year of the woman, the pink wave, which I still would love to figure out a different term for. But right now we have, 136 Democrats running for president, right, against Trump? Or have five more added just in the past few, 139 now?
Actually, it's almost, it literally is almost 500 because because all you have to do to run for president is file two pieces of paper with the Federal Election Commission.
Touche, okay.
But most of them are just crackpots.
Speaking of women, though.
No offense if any of you are running for
president. That was on the record.
No offense to any presidential candidates in the room with us.
CNN's going to be running that tonight. But you do have Kamala Harris, Kristen Gillibrand. From your national perspective, does a Gretchen Whitmer, how would her name come up in those circles, right? Like, how does that work?
Well, I think that if you're a general election candidate, if you're the nominee for your party for president, you would love to have a governor from your party in office in a big swing state, like in Michigan. So... there's a political operation that is ready-made, to help you out. I think a big example of how helpful it is to have someone in office on your side is during the 2000 presidential election when Florida went to a recount, and who was governor of Florida at the time? The candidate's brother, Jeb Bush, and so that really gave the Bush the George W. Bush operation a huge leg up as they were entering into this recount phase, because they had all the you know, lawyers and the political infrastructure already set up, whereas the Gore campaign was playing catch up in many respects. But anyway, but to have the infrastructure of the governor's office in a big state is a big boon for candidates, and the fact that, you know, if the nominee is a woman, and you know they have that simpatico thing going, you know, there's a dynamic there that you know, on the Republican side that they're not going to be able to tap into.
Yeah, I think Whitmer has definitely emerged as a sort of a rock star out of the 2018 cycle for Democrats. Partially that's because the big narrative of a national blue wave didn't quite live up to the expectations, and partially because a lot of the sort of Bernie Sanders style insurgents didn't pull off wins. Whitmer ended up being sort of the one of the most notable wins for Democrats nationwide. She got a lot of attention because of that. She continues to. Matthew Iglesias from Vox suggested that the rebuttal to President Trump's State of the Union address should just be Gretchen Whitmer saying, "Fix the damn roads," for 5 minutes. She's going to get a lot of attention. I mean, as far as presidential politics go, I think you joked about how many Democrats are running for president already. There's only so many donors to go around. I don't think anybody's going to be begging Democrats to get into the race. I think they've got enough as is. But I think Whitmer, certainly, I wouldn't be surprised if there is running mate speculation, or simply she's just going to be a powerful advocate for candidates. Kirsten Gillibrand, she announced her run on the Colbert Show, or Colbert, I don't know how he pronounces
welcome,
it now that he's not the character
anymore.
Welcome
to 2019.
He actually gave her a plane ticket to Michigan to campaign here, because it's expected to be another key player again this year, and she went out of her way to give Governor Whitmer a shout out and praise her, and note that she actually came here and campaigned with Whitmer last year as well. So certainly it's going to be Whitmer will be a good ally for Democrats to have as they campaign here.
If your name is Joseph R. Biden Jr. and you're 77 years old and you win the Democratic nomination next year and you knock off a lot of East Coast, West Coast women, you're going to be looking to a Midwest woman to be your running mate. I'm going to make that prediction right now.
Decent analysis there, Alive and Good.
You beer me.
You heard it here.
You heard it here first.
Beer
okay,
me.
Another question in the back. Beer me. Throw me in, coach.
I'd like to know if the panel could discuss the fact that the Supreme Court is going to have to decide whether or not they hear or decide to rule on the Louisiana case that's coming up, a situation the court has already ruled on once, but now the balance has switched. Now they're going to have to decide basically an issue that was exact same wording and the exact same issues, but with different judges, and that has to do with specific details regarding the abortion issue, clinics and restrictions on physicians that can perform those procedures being within 30 minutes of a hospital, et cetera. I'm concerned, or I'm wondering if this new balance of Supreme Court justices is going to result in them reopening that issue.
I'll just say I haven't covered this. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, though, certainly with the new makeup. The fact that they're taking the case suggests they're going to give it a fresh look. I'll say from the perspective here in Michigan, it might have been much more impactful a couple years ago when the GOP Republicans controlled the governor's office and the legislature. I mean, I doubt the legislature is going to be able to pass significant abortion restrictions under Governor Whitmer. I mean, they won't be able to. So, you know, the impact could be muted here, at least initially, if the Supreme Court were to open up the door to those sort of restrictive laws.
Yeah, the justice that who Brett Kavanaugh replaced, Anthony Kennedy, who was a Ronald Reagan appointee. He was kind of a mixed bag on abortion, but with Sandra Day O'Connor and John Paul Stevens off the court, he was the, I guess, most open to abortion rights of any of the Republican appointed justices. And he'd taking kind of the swing vote position on a lot of close issues. So the fact that that Kennedy is the one who was replaced by Kavanaugh, and that the Scalia seat was held in the conservative column. I in some ways I hate gamifying the Supreme Court, but it's sometimes it's the easiest way to conceptualize what's going on. But yeah, so it's from Kavanaugh's rulings thus far. I don't know if there's been a specific abortion case yet, but I don't think there's been a lot of indication that he's veering far from the conservative playbook. And so the fact that, you know, that his approach is replacing the approach of Anthony Kennedy, I think probably is an indication of, you know, how an abortion ruling would go.
And I was just going to add, I mean, again, talking a little bit about you, Maryland and Massachusetts and sort of this idea, right, that you change laws with some idea or, you know, portends that it's going to be a certain outcome is a little bit like that with the Supreme Court, as we've seen for decades, that sometimes justices that were appointed by conservative presidents sometimes end up making some of the more liberal decisions. So with any kind of Supreme Court, again, like not wanting to gamesmanship it, we've also seen justices change over many decades and how they've ruled.
And you know, one of President Trump's least favorite justices, there aren't that many to choose from, but he is not a fan of John Roberts, who was kind of surprised a lot of people with his vote on different the Affordable Care Act individual mandate ruling, and I think there was at least one other one. But yeah, Trump's very quick to, and they actually had like a back and forth recently about politicizing the court, where they were very critical of each other. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, a John Roberts or someone might do something unexpected, but yeah, it's hard to say.
Well, we're talking about gaming the Supreme Court. I'll just note the Michigan Supreme Court is very fascinating right now, if anyone pays attention to that. Democrats did pick up a Democratic nominee, won a seat this year, so it's still a 5-4 GOP nominee majority.
4-3.
Excuse me. Sorry, I knew it was one. But there's the court. You know, still a GOP majority picked a Democratic nominee to be the Chief Justice, and there emerged already late last year, before the Democrat Judge Kavanaugh, her name is, won nomination or won election, that already we saw sort of a block of two Republicans and two Democrats working together. So there's a fascinating dynamics in play right there. Came up in the gerrymandering case. The fact that it was allowed on the ballot was because Justice Beth Clement, the Republican nominee, and David Viviano, I believe, are part of a new block that sided with Democrats and allowed that on the ballot. So some very interesting dynamics right there.
Yeah, Bridget Mary McCormick, now Chief Justice. It's a fascinating Michigander to keep an eye on right now. Yeah.
Okay. I would like to take advantage of the expertise that we have up there on state politics to maybe give a little more background on Gretchen Whitmer, you know, and how she's kind of built, not really a machine, but she came from always being mentioned years ago to all of a sudden, you know, just sneakily coming up and dominating and kicking Schuette's butt and, you know, the whole thing. And so I'd like a little background on how she's done this and what machine that she has, you know, that she's using to her advantage.
Well, let's start with her background and her family, because Gretchen Whitmer sort of is a Lansingite, born and bred. Her mother worked for Attorney General for many years.
Frank Kelly.
Her father was the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield. She went to school at Michigan State University, became a lawyer at Michigan State University, started as working in the legislature for Dem policy staff. Was that it? Rick would remember. And Rick, in fact, Pluta behind, remembers Gretchen Whitmer's first House floor speech, right? and you will still remind her that you remember her first floor speech. But many people will talk about the fact, right, that Gretchen Whitmer is probably the most experienced politician, whether you liked him or not, since John Engler. That this is someone that knows Lansing, and there's so much tension right now about insiders and outsiders, right, that you don't want D.C. insiders, you don't want Lansing insiders. But then among political circles, there's a lot of talk about, well, maybe that's why Rick Snyder in some capacities failed so much, was because he didn't understand that culture. And so that's a sort of long way of saying that she was sort of Lansing, from Lansing, and is, I think, really using that background from the first day and maybe into the first 100 and her first 4 years, because she knows the landscape and she knows how that town operates.
Yeah, but knowing the landscape and actually navigating it are two different things. And these much vaunted legislative skills have yet to been put to test. I mean, the biggest test is going to be whether she can get an extra dollar out of this legislature to fix roads, and whether she can really convince them to raise revenues. I mean, she said that was going to be her plan. If she does, she couldn't get them to do it, she's going to go to the ballot. Convincing the Michigan voters they need to take out several billions of dollars in new state debt. I've called this the get out the damn credit card plan, because that's basically what we're asking. So John Engler did. At the late 90s, we're still paying several hundreds of millions of dollars in debt service every year that could be going to roads. And so Rick Snyder, I mean, he tried as much as he could get. He ended up just throwing the flag in and took a $600 million tax increase and a $600 million cut out of the general fund. But her challenge is going to be to convince the public that the general fund is no longer sustainable. We can't tap it. And just for context, the general fund has grown by about $300 million or 3% this century. Inflation would have had it grown $3 billion. And so it's, you know, state government is pretty, at least the general fund wise, it's pretty much, pretty meager. They run a pretty frugal operation for the most part. And so there's not a lot of room there. And so now her challenge is actually to convince the legislature to do something.
And yet, rabbit hole, and then I want to get to you guys, but a recent Michigan State University report came out and said, and yet Michiganders think like they are more taxed than ever before. Which I just find is so interesting, right, that actually when you look at the numbers, that's not the fact, and yet the overall thought is that taxes are highest than ever.
There's actually a formula built into state law that, you know, the government can only impose a certain amount of tax on per income, and that's actually at an all-time low. That said, nobody likes taxes. They're very hard to get through, and we know from Rhodes Proposal 1 in 2015 that voters often reject them too, so it's a tough problem. Republican lawmakers are complaining about the push for any new taxes, saying, "Well, the taxes we just approved in 2015, we got hell for them, and people are still mad about the roads." And the counter argument, of course, is that, well, maybe if they'd done a bigger tax, the roads would have actually been fixed, and maybe people would be a little happier about it. But regardless, I mean, it's a tough sell for lawmakers who, in the state house in particular, have to run for election every 2 years and sell that to voters in their districts.
Just last week, a group of, it's called elder statesmen, former legislators, former Lieutenant Governor John Cherry, former Republican Senate Majority Leader Ken Sikkema, former Senator Bob Emerson, who was Budget Director for Granholm, and Steve Tabachman, former rep from Detroit.
It was Hilligans. Tabachman's part of the group, but
Tabachman, yeah. Hilligans, former House Speaker from the mid-90s. They came up with a plan to raise the gas tax. They called this the consensus plan, by 47 cents over 9 years. 7 cents in the first year, and then 5 cents for the next 8 years, essentially to graze $2.45 billion, and then add in some other new revenue. It's going to be $2.7 billion a year by the ninth year. I mean, this 2.7 is what the engineers say we need today. So this is kind of putting it off into another decade. But I mean, this plan's going over like a lead balloon, you know, but they're trying to sort of make an argument that this is what we really need. I mean, this is what we need to get roads up to better condition, because this current plan, this $1.2 billion plan, MDOT says that roads currently, the trunk line roads, the highways, the M's, the U.S., the federal the interstates, about 65% of them are good or fair condition today. And in about 5 years, like 55% of them will be good or fair condition. So even as this more money is coming in, it's clearly not coming in fast enough to keep up with the decline of our pavement.
And there's another question back here, but I want a just purely political question, because this is, you know, issues and ails, and that's what we like to do here. I mean, how much time does Gretchen Whitmer have? What's left for her to put out a roads plan before people thaw, freeze cycle, and are starting to go, okay, fix the damn roads, we're in April, we're in May. Does it have to be state of the state? Does it have to be before budget conferences, revenue estimating? Like, well, when does she have to do it?
We know it's going to be the budget proposal. I mean, she'll probably touch on it in her state of the state address, but the nuts and bolts of her proposal are going to come during her budget address, which is likely to be in early March. Then, I mean, the question isn't when does she propose it, it's when does she get anything done, and that's a very open question. I mean, Chad mentioned the idea of bonding. That was her backup plan on the campaign. I still think it's the most realistic scenario to get the legislature to sign off on, to let voters decide whether they want to take out huge new debt that ultimately will cost the state much more to take care of a problem that they could take care of by raising taxes, but won't. Not to say it's the best solution.
Yeah, and the first week of March is when this budget, her budget will come out. And then the way this usually works is they try to get the budget in the last couple of years. They want to get the budget done by June because they like to have their summers off at the legislature, and don't you all? So this will be hot and heavy right in the thick of pothole season, and we'll see what kind of plan, if it's anything different. I mean, Rick Snyder asked for a 25-cent gas tax increase, and he got it through the Senate like twice. But he every time he ran into Republican House speakers who just told him pound sand, I always look back at like what was Rick Snyder's legacy, that lame duck session of 2014, where he tried to get this issue kind of resolved, and then they came up with this Christmas tree that was Proposal mm-hmm. 1 that Gretchen Whitmer was involved in, adding ornaments to it, and that ended up going down in flames. And then we've just been basically in this stagnant, it's been 4.5 years now since this sort of demise of that proposal.
They like to get the budget done by June. They don't have to. The state year starts October 1. We haven't had any non-emergency government shutdowns in many years, but we'll see whether Whitmer demands, whether she'll say, I won't sign a budget if it doesn't include road funding. I mean, things could get very interesting if that happens. But the Republican legislature could simply send her a budget without the road money and ask her to sign it as well. So,
yeah, I found this to be such an interesting issue because Fix the Damn Roads is such a tangible promise. I'm trying really hard not to say concrete promise, but it's such.
And yet you just did.
I did.
Yeah.
I couldn't resist.
Yeah.
So one of the classes I teach at U of M is about campaign messaging, how candidates shape their messages, and Fix the Damn Roads is a great message to run on if you're trying to get elected, but it's not a great message if you're trying to get reelected. Because the question is, if you're an incumbent governor, Gretchen Whitmer, running for re-election on the Fix the Damn Roads platform, the question is, you've been governor for 3 or 4 years. What have you been doing? And it's something that everyone relates with, and every voter is going to have their own personal definition of whether the roads are fixed or not. And so I've been very curious to see how the issue will play out and what the metric for success is, because there's going to be some level where it's not, where people are going to feel that the damn roads aren't fixed.
There's a fine line between fix the damn roads as a celebratory rallying cry and fix the damn roads as an angry outcry, much like thanks Obama can have very different meanings depending on context and inflection.
Okay, yeah.
I really appreciate you talking about gerrymandering because if there's an issue that's going to get me worked up, it's gerrymandering. But I'd also like to hear a little bit about term limits and how term limits have negatively affected our state government.
Well,
Where do we start? So
term limits to me is actually like if I got to go off and be in Robert's class and get to talk about all these political things. Term limits for me would be one of the most interesting because of the dichotomy between how much I think most folks who've watched Lansing for so many years believe that they've just been so instrumental into the crumbling of Michigan in many ways, and yet how it remains so popular among Michigan voters. And I was actually speaking with a class, Joe Schwartz, who's a former congressman. I was speaking to a U of M class of his, and I was trying to explain to a bunch of U of M students about term limits and some of the issues that term limits have brought in Michigan, and they just couldn't get over the fact that no, term limits were absolutely what you should have, that absolutely they were better for the state. And it was so interesting, and I wasn't trying to get them to agree by any means, but just talking it out, and that there is still this belief that term limits are incredibly important, that they make sure that you get rid of the graft and all the things like that, when really what we've seen a lot in Lansing is, so the folks that used to have all this power who were lawmakers, now a lot of that power is held by lobbyists and the quick turnover.
Or the bureaucracy.
Chad, you said, where do we start? We've got about 5 minutes before this ends, so 30 seconds,
well,
term limits.
I wrote a column about a year ago or so, kind of equating that I tried to write to my business audience that we have turned the legislature over to the junior associate of the legislature, where we are promoting someone with 4 years experience, sometimes two, to be the Speaker of the House. And the Speaker of the House is the most powerful position in Lansing, sort of the governor. I mean, it's very, very powerful position in the legislature to move votes. And we are turning over someone who has very little on-the-job training. And we wouldn't do that for a $56 billion corporation that is the state of Michigan. We wouldn't do that at General Motors. The board wouldn't allow that. I mean, you wouldn't do that any other kind
I've
of
I've heard it about surgeons.
Business.
Would you want your surgeon who after 8 years you're like, well, you've done a fantastic job.
And then you get fired after 2 years. I mean, we're on our third speaker in a row on a two-year term. We're just kind of going through them. And we don't have anybody who has a lot of long-term experience. And then what also happens is, yes, we got rid of the Dominic Jacobettis, who was this corrupt House Appropriations Chairman from the UP, who basically was the poster child for why they wanted term limits in the early 90s to break up, his monopoly on the House Appropriations Committee and in the legislature. But we traded that for a system where our legislative leadership is walking out of the Capitol right into high-priced consulting jobs. The former House Speaker last year, Tom Leonard, is now Dan Gilbert's legislative strategist. The Senate Appropriations Chair, the one I told you about earlier, who couldn't remember where $10 million went in the budget, he walked out of the appropriations room into a job at one of the biggest multi-client lobbying firms, Kelly Coughlin, to be specialized in lobbying the appropriations committees. I mean, this happens now every 2 years. These guys just churn through. Arlen Meekoff, the Senate Majority Leader, has hung his hat out for business, and Jace Bulger works for the DeVos family now. I mean, he's a former House Speaker. So that's what we get now is they leave the legislature, but they're never really quite gone. Not some of them do, but they stay and they find ways to work around and influence their old friends.
Just for context, Michigan has arguably the strictest term limit laws in the nation. Some other states have similar total time spans, but for instance, allow lawmakers to serve their entire tenure in Lansing in one or the other of the chambers. For instance, if somebody served in the state house for 14 years, maybe by year 10, they might make a better speaker. They might be more informed as a committee chairman, et cetera. And yeah, as Chad mentioned, the revolving door is a real issue. The obvious effect of term limits is that people outside of the legislature have all of the institutional knowledge and are the ones who then are recommending, telling, slash taking people out to lunch and urging them to act certain ways on legislature, on legislation. Michigan is in a very small minority of states that has no cooling off period for state legislators to go directly into lobbying when they leave office. So another reason, going back to the gerrymandering, to the FOIA, that Michigan is considered one of the least transparent states.
Other than that, how is the play, Mrs. Lincoln? It makes you kind of look at Lansing with a different eye. And Robert, just quickly as we wrap up, I mean, are these issues that you see in states across the country, or is Michigan special in all of our issueness?
Well, there was a push in the late 90s and early 2000s, I remember, to have federal term limits for Congress, but ultimately it was ruled unconstitutional. But I think term limits in general is, this may sound obvious, but it's an indication of voter anger, voter frustration, or feelings that the system is broken. And how do you fix the system? And the most expedient way to do that is, oh, we'll just throw the bums out because they're corrupt. But I think ultimately the ultimate term limit is voting.
Right.
You know, if you like someone, vote to keep them in office. And if you don't, vote them out. But I can understand the feelings of frustration on the part of the voters.
On that note, I will just make a selfish claim for all of the journalists here, which is, you know, a lot of these things that we've talked about happen because there's not as many journalists as there are in Lansing as there once was. And I will make a claim that I think Cranes and the Detroit News and Michigan Radio do some of the best reporting on Lansing. But I think all of us wish that there were three times, four times as many of us like there were decades ago to tell these stories. And so if you're so inclined to support the journalists that do all this work, who can at least bring some of this information to light a little more, to support those stations. And if not, just give Robert Yoon money, who's not working for a station. Just throw Robert some cash. So Robert Yoon, Chad Livengood, Jonathan Osting, thank you so much for coming tonight. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you, everyone.